Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Law Debating Society entitled The International Aspects of the Libyan Crisis. This talk is chaired by Dr. David Frigiri.
Thanks for coming to this second debate organized by the Law Debating Society. We're organizing it once again in conjunction, in collaboration with the ELSA, the European Law Students Association, and INSL, the new board of INSL, actually, so I congratulate them for their election. You will recall that the first debate tackled divorce, the fairly local issue of divorce, and we tackled it through the framework of the common good argument versus individual rights, or the common good and individual rights. Today the aim is to leave this, well, we can say local, the local idiosyncrasies of the debate on divorce and to go a bit more international. In fact, the debate today is about the Libyan crisis. The nature of this crisis and perhaps the proximity to Malta might go some way in explaining why our panel is a bit small today. Nonetheless, we have the pleasure to welcome two experts in their field, anthropology lecturer Dr. Ranier Sadni, who is currently Director Operations at the European Commission League of Arab States Liaison Office. He has conducted fieldwork in Western Libya and is, as you know, a regular contributor to the press on Arab issues. We also have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Christopher Soller. You probably know him well. He's a leading expert in international criminal law and, of course, a lecturer both in criminal law and international law at this university. Dr. Kevin Aquilina, who is the head of public law at this university, will also field questions largely linked to Malta's neutrality clause. To get the ball rolling, and due to the fact that Dr. Sadni has another appointment at 1, but he's been very kind to accept this invitation, I'll start by posing a few questions to Dr. Sadni about the situation within Libya. So, basically, you have written, Dr. Sadni, a lot about Libya's tribes, and what I'd like to do is ask you what exactly is happening within Libya. Is this a civil war? Is it a tribal war? Does this, if this is the case, does this explain perhaps why Gaddafi has managed to hold on to power, which Mubarak and Ben Ali did not manage to do after the revolutions kicked off? If this is a tribal or civil war, indeed, does this factor impinge on the justification for international intervention, which we will then tackle also leading on to Dr. Soller's intervention? So I leave the floor to Ranier.
Thank you, and I would like to thank the Law Society for their invitation, and I'm sorry that I will not be able to stay till the end. What I'm giving, of course, will be a strictly personal view in reply to your questions. I won't quite take them in the order you've given me. I'll switch the first and the second question around. In other words, I think your question, why has Gaddafi managed to hold out, should be tackled earlier than is this a civil or a tribal war. And I won't even quite take the question as why has Gaddafi managed to hold out straightforwardly? There is a simple, short answer, but it doesn't exhaust the reasons. I mean, the obvious answer is he is much better armed than the rebels. And it is just a sheer brute fact of all 20th century revolutions that they are much more bloody than, say, the French Revolution, which in our consciousness, perhaps because of the guillotine, is etched in, as a very bloody revolution. But 20th century revolutions, because of the much sharper imbalance of military power between the state and whoever is revolting against it, have tended to be much more bloody. So there is a strong imbalance. But there are other reasons, and we should perhaps tackle them by saying, what has actually enabled Muammar Gaddafi to rule a country for so long, 42 years? And we need to remember that Libya is in many ways an unusual country. Many commentators attribute Libya's uniqueness, and it is unique, to Gaddafi's personality, and sometimes so does the Libyan opposition. But it isn't quite that. It's already unusual in the fact that it combines huge oil wealth, that is to say over 90% of the Libyan state's revenues come from oil, with the idea of revolution. Gaddafi was impelled by a sense of wanting to be a revolutionary, not just in the wider world, but even within Libya itself. And that would already distinguish him from the Gulf states, and practically all states except for Iraq under Saddam Hussein, which also had a revolutionary rhetoric, although its economy did not have over 90% of its revenues coming from oil. And that's important to remember, because for Gaddafi has faced armed insurrection or attempted coup d'etat before. One or two reasons why he has managed to rule, and even for a long time with some legitimacy, or at least with pronounced ambivalence at best on the part of Libyans, have been two factors. The first is that the oil wealth gave him deep enough pockets to be able to address unease with the Jamahiriya by subsidizing consumption, essentially, subsidizing housing, subsidizing cars, creating jobs in municipalities or in institutes in the middle of the desert to address certain needs. So deep pockets because of oil. And the second is because actually this, despite the strong ideological rhetoric and periods of harsh application of the ideologies, particularly starting from the 1980s onwards, but then stopping for a period during the 1990s, the Libyan Jamahiriya was generally, at least on some issues, very responsive to popular needs. I don't have time to go into detail, but I'll just say that one of the ways in which this responsiveness worked was that the revolutionary avant-garde, such as it was generally posted to its own hometowns. Now, what has happened this time round is that those two previous sources of strength have actually become a source of weakness. There's been a tipping point reached. The fact that the person sent to put down the revolt in Benghazi was from that area, his former interior minister, as well as some of the brigades were staffed by people from that area. In this case meant that given the harsh order even to bomb aerially people they knew or people who might be distantly related, meant they actually went over to the other side. They crossed the line of responsiveness. The second thing concerns oil. Oil wealth is useful for a prince in Niccolo Machiavelli's sense, not just because it gives you a lot of revenues, but also because you don't depend a lot on your own local workforce. If you like, you can bring in a foreign workforce. It's a mode of production which is located in just a few places. Here what happened is, once again, a tipping point was crossed. It's actually vulnerable to capture once you've lost control over the security. And that happened too, making the rebellion very threatening. However, what is making it difficult for the rebels is that what used to be a strength of rebellion traditionally in a country like Libya, even before it was called Libya, even in the Ottoman period and before, what used to be a source of strength was that it was a country that is difficult to control, that by a pre-modern state, which is to say, a state would not have, in which the gap between the army and the tribal resistance was not that great, in which you didn't have the means of surveillance under your control and the means of communication under your control, which meant that there were many places which were isolated and you had to go up a mountain to capture them. And that was difficult. You only had that intermittently. Well, that has now swung against the rebels, because their relative isolation means that you do have a number of towns that manage to rebel and, so to speak, capture the town enough to be able to fly an anti-Gaddafi banner with impunity. But that also meant that what they managed to do was not all that consequential for the whole of Libya. They remained a local problem because they couldn't leave their town and march on to Tripoli. So what we have is a political geography where the fact that Libya is the fourth largest country in Africa, but with one of the smallest populations of Africa, means that any local problem can remain a local problem if it can be contained and can be returned to later. Secondly, it also leads to the fact that even if you've lost a place, you can, if you capture it, you gobble up lots of empty space around it, which is why we've had these wild swings, as they seem, watching things on TV, between the rebel victories. They don't just capture a town, they then march about 100 kilometers or more. And then when they retreat, they really retreat. It's a bit like a Tom and Jerry game, and that's because you've got towns with huge empty spaces in between. And that has tipped against the rebels. One of the most important things that Gaddafi has managed to do is keep control over Tripoli, which, in turn, taking greater Tripoli into account, may have between a third to near half of Libya's population. That is one of the critical factors and what makes it different from Tunisia and Egypt, where people were gathering in the squares with impunity and having an effect. Is this a civil war? I would distinguish that from whether it's a tribal war. I don't think so. Now, we have to be careful here. The information we're getting is very fragmentary, phoning friends or even phoning your parents if you're a Libyan from Malta will not yield much information, or at least maybe what I should say for the record is that phone people up and they tell you things have never been so grand. So that's not very helpful. But it does appear to be that so far this is a battle between militias and rebels from certain towns. It's important to emphasize that it isn't quite, at least as far as we can make out, a rebellion between the whole of the Libyan people and Muammar Gaddafi. There are important tribes which between them would go from Sirte, more or less bang in the middle of the Libyan coastline, down to the south, that have not pronounced themselves. Now, there have sometimes been declarations, but they've been equivocal. I can explain later why they've been equivocal. But I wouldn't even count the list by Bernard-Henri Lévy, published last week, of the 61 tribes, as defining. I mean, he does say that what that list indicates is that this is not an East-West conflict. What you might have are tribes and ambivalence between tribes, or possibly disagreements within tribes. But then some of the major tribes are not taking a public stand in a way that would be recognized as such within Libya. Some people have suggested that one should be careful that what is happening in the East, in Benghazi, is a tribal takeover. And that is because they've noted that there are some of the most important council members are coming from the same tribe. Well, insofar as that is true, it's largely because this tribe is a very large tribe which almost encompasses the whole of eastern, the half of eastern Libya. So it's a bit like fearing that the south of Malta is taking over Malta if many of them are represented in government. It's quite easy if it's half the Maltese population. I mean, it's also provoked by the fact that only about 13 of the council's 30 members are known. The others have remained anonymous, it has been said, in order to protect them, because they haven't been able to join the council physically from where they're living. But I would think that if it were a tribal takeover, people within Libya would have noticed, and they would have taken actions. The fact that they haven't, that in itself hasn't provoked a polarization, leads me to think that there isn't the evidence for it. I should say that a lot of the fear has been based on whether you're going to have an east-west tribal conflict, and suggesting that an east-west tribal conflict is the pattern of Libyan history. It's not. The pattern of Libyan history is north-south conflict between the cities and the tribes of the interior. East and West led generally autonomous lives until independence, and then when there some rivalry arose, it arose not on the basis of tribal identity, but on the basis of the identity of the provinces. So on a different basis. I would caution anyone, and I would start by myself, concerning any declaration about tribes, no matter how expert and confident the person speaking appears to be. And please begin by being skeptical of what I'm saying. First of all, I have seen some astounding nonsense written by certain intelligence dossiers. I can only convey it by saying this. I have seen the Warfalla, which is a confederation of 52 tribes, as they say in the commission, the tribe I know best, described in terms that if it was someone describing Malta, it would be someone self-confidently looking at you and telling you Malta is divided into six major groups. Labourites, people from Slema, St. Joseph Band Club, priests, Gozitans, and Maltese. I mean, it's not just that they're getting names wrong, and which only pedants would mind. It's that they're confusing completely different categories. And the second thing is that even people who would know Libyans very well, like Muammar Gaddafi himself, or the rebels, have occasionally been surprised by how things have turned out. It is said that Gaddafi was surprised that the Barasa tribe of Beida in the east joined the rebellion very early on, because his second wife, that is to say the wife he's had since 1970, and therefore the mother of all his children, or his biological children, but one, is from that tribe. I mean, the police chief of Beida went over with the rebellion, and if he was police chief, it was for a very good reason. I mean, he was considered to be sympathetic to Gaddafi's revolution. Gaddafi has been surprised, and there have been some other incidents, but even the rebels have been surprised. I remember seeing an author, a Libyan author, on a book on Libyan tribes and politics, telling an Al Jazeera interviewer confidently, The fact that this General Haftar has returned from the United States will lead to the collapse of Sirte, because he's from the tribe of the Ferjan, a major tribe, one of these that haven't actually declared themselves. And they will rise in his favor. Well, they didn't. Considerations concerning foreign intervention. I think the major issue would boil down to how to treat the National Transitional Council. And there the issue is, it does seem to be fragmented from within, to go by reports from the International Crisis Group. There are Islamists that are part of it, but there are also very ardent secularists that are part of it. And according to this International Crisis Group representative, Nicholas Pelham, he thinks the main danger may come not from the Council being recognized, but if it collapses because of its internal divisions, leaving people to look towards the Islamists, who themselves say they're Democrats. Whether one therefore should recognize the Council, of course, doesn't immediately follow from that, because there are questions concerning its legitimacy in the sense that it is self-appointed. But it is a consideration to keep in mind. I would also, should there be, and it's a big if, opposed Gaddafi scenario, there is also an issue concerning what would appear to be the most promising candidate to lead the new Libya. There will be a huge temptation in the West, of course, to treat the most acceptable person to be the person who is most fluent in English. That won't necessarily be the person who will be most acceptable to the Libyans. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Sadni. I'm not sure whether we can open now briefly the floor to students, to, for you to take a couple of questions before you leave. So now's the opportunity. Be brief, please, because, you know, Dr. Sadni must leave in the next 5 to 10 minutes, if we can stretch it a bit. So we can do that now and, you know, try to stick to the subject, of course.
Can I please state
the Fezzan, the Cyrenaica district, and the Tripoli district. And when King Idris, who was at that time the king when I was living there, managed to keep them all together, practically because he had an Italian civil service still running. The British still held some hospitals and that, but it was the Italian civil service that kept him there. And at that time, the oil was being discovered. It was just the beginning. BP was the company that was mostly exploiting oil at that time.
Keep it short, get to the question. If we can get to the question. I mean.
My question is that I don't agree that Gaddafi is all alone. He has immediately implicated religion on his side. That's why he changed the flag. So he had a bolstering up of his regime with religion, religious sentiments. And that, I think, helped quite a lot. The other point is he made up Jamahariya, a new concept of sort of a parliament, you can call it that way, made up of tribes of representatives, whatever he invented at that time. And that, I think, kept going for about 43 years until this recent upheaval. This educated a sort of dictatorship. And he was always against the people of the Cyrenaica district, always, making sure that his henchmen, the people around him, were all from Tripolitania. Fezzan never so much entered into the area, but the people from Cyrenaica were excluded. In fact, that small revolution that took place some years ago was an explanation of this fact. As regards the future, it's all in God's hands, as we say. But sure, Gaddafi did a lot of benefit to the country. He made the Libyans realize that they were a nation, because under King Idris, it was just ex-colonial of Italy, practically. But Gaddafi made the nation realize that they really belonged to a flag, and that they had to have a flag. That's why he changed the flag, so that he wanted to introduce a new regime completely.
I should take all the questions.
Probably the question of the divide.
I have to stop here for the time being. Then we'll take the other questions on the more.
Okay. Well, if I implied that Gaddafi was all alone, then I'm sorry that I didn't communicate that correctly. There wasn't just Jallu, there was a full group there were more than two of revolutionary free officers. There was, as happens with many such coups, a general pruning of the original group, so that by the 1980s it was Jallu and another person who remained. But here the issue is that with respect to the Jamahariya vision, I mean, that has generally been attributed to Muammar Gaddafi. But he did find many people who responded to it. I thought I had addressed the issue of whether he's alone or not alone by saying that, in fact, there was, for many years, a sense of legitimacy or at most ambivalence to what he did. And also that there were people who joined up as a revolutionary vanguard in their own hometowns. So yeah, of course, it was by no means alone. In my own experience, I could see that, for example, people of a traditional lower status or secondary status, whether they're because of their color or because of their tribal identity or because of they were women, found in the revolution an egalitarianism that actually helped them advance more than they would have if things had remained the same. So there's no doubt about that at all. Concerning the three states, I mean, no, people from the Fezzan were involved in the revolution, again, because you will find a disproportionate number of black people, simply, again, because they found the egalitarian strand, as were some people from the East, like his former interior minister, who was from the East. But there is no doubt that the eastern part of the country tended to resent him more. The issue with respect to religion and what has happened now, well, his claims about religion have tended always to be the more controversial by Libyan standards. No, because he challenged traditional Islamic authority, including that of the scholars, some of which Libyans could accept, others which in some cases actually bordered on heresy. I mean, I could give you examples. I mean, things I heard him say myself, you know, like if the Quran had come down in Sweden, maybe alcohol would have been permitted, which is, I can't tell you the scandal that would constitute, because you're relativizing the Quran. So, on those issues, he was generally considered to be a bit idiosyncratic. So, when I think the essential issue is what has happened is that the king was kept in place not just because of the Italian civil service. The king became king because he wasn't coming from a royal family, because of A, of his knowledge of the tribes of eastern Libya, and B, because the people of western Libya were too divided among themselves and rather would have had him. Now, what happened was that the king, with time, began to lose touch with the Libya that was developing under his own rule. There was also the strong sense of nationalism concerning his foreign policy, which was objected to. Now, something that has happened in Libya today is that tribes, partly because of Gaddafi's own policies, have developed in ways, and identity has developed in ways that is making some of the major precepts of the Jamahariya much more difficult to cohere with people's idea. That, and the fact that the once Gaddafi's children grew up, the personal nature of the order became more obvious. There's something else I would like to highlight, which began from the 1990s, so before the children grew up. Up until the early 1990s, there was a strong revolutionary ethos, so that the disparities of wealth that there were, and people knew about them, did not often show themselves in public. I mean, the true revolutionary was someone without a tie. I mean, the wealth might be shown in the kind of car that was driven, but otherwise there was a general austerity shown. In the 1990s, progressively, the disparities of wealth were more on display. You had important shops opening on the high streets with prices that were beyond the reach of many Libyans. So there was always a danger, even given the record of tension in post-1969 Libya, that the more the economy opened up and actually people's standard of living got better, the more danger you had of disquiet, simply because, sociologically speaking, the greatest dangers for a political order such as Libya is when you're actually opening up the economy and people's standards are improving, but not as fast as that of certain others. I think that is partly what explains a major rebellion in 1993. And also, what I thought from the mid 2000s, I thought could happen.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Sadni, for that.
Democracies are very good at handling different ideologies. I mean, it's about containing political disagreement within certain bounds and creating harmony as much as possible out of different voices. Tribes themselves are not necessarily undemocratic. They may not have political parties. I mean, Gaddafi's own original idea, I think the Green Book, which some people have made fun of, I think shows, at least in terms of the questions it raises, a genuine intellectual tackling of certain basic issues. I mean, you may have strong doubts about the answers, but I think the underlying questions are good ones. So you may be able to have all kinds of consultational institutions. For a country like Libya, I would think it's not so much the tribal issue. Because there are different kinds of tribes, and the word tribe carries baggage in European languages, which it doesn't carry necessarily in a country like Libya. I mean, I think there would tend to be a general consensus against what is called tribalism in Libya, but not for tribal social solidarity. I think the issue is not so much tribes, but the oil wealth. It is very difficult to have a transparent, operational democracy in a country with those kinds of revenues from a single source. And the people who will be helping you lose your way democratically will also be the democracies of the West.
Thanks, Dr. Sadni. Thanks a lot for your very, very interesting intervention.
Thanks a lot. That's it.
Obviously, given the setup in the region, which Dr. Sadni explained very thoroughly, and also given this new phenomenon of an increasing, a great advancement and sophistication in information technology, to the extent that most information is easily accessible globally within a matter of minutes, I think the Security Council would have considered primarily the evidence it has at hand, at least on a prima facie basis, in order to determine whether, at least at first glance, there could be the necessity to apply any measures which the United Nations Charter itself allows it to apply and permits, in the sense that the United Nations Charter allows a gradual escalation of measures intended to protect the lives of human beings. Now, Article 39 of the Charter specifically speaks of three circumstances wherein such measures could be taken by the Security Council and by the UN in general. We're speaking of an act of aggression, a threat to the peace, and a breach of the peace. The United Nations, definitely the Security Council, would have considered the acts allegedly committed by the Gaddafi regime as such. And in fact, if one considers the contents and wording of the resolution itself, one notes, for example, that the resolution refers to, in its preamble, recalling the Libyan authorities' responsibility to protect its population, expressing concern at the plight of refugees forced to flee the violence in Libya, considering that the widespread and systematic attacks currently taking place in Libya against the civilian population may amount to crimes against humanity, amongst many other statements which form part of Resolution 1970 of the 26th February 2011. Particularly noticeable in this context is the fact that the resolution was unanimously taken. And this varies from the only other resolution taken in the past years in the case of Darfur in 2005, wherein the International Criminal Court's jurisdiction was triggered. According to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, the jurisdiction of the court can be triggered in three ways, either by the chief prosecutor in proprio motu, by his own initiative, or by the Security Council, as has happened recently, or else by a state party. Now, in this case, we have a very anomalous, peculiar, and particular situation of the Security Council triggering the jurisdiction, hence the legal authority, of the International Criminal Court in relation to a citizen or citizens belonging to a state which is not a state party, which is not a signatory to the convention. And this is quite unprecedented. It happened in the case of Sudan as well, when Omar al-Bashir was indicted for crimes against humanity and subsequently for genocide in relation to the conflict in Darfur. So this is particularly noticeable and important from an international point of view, because it sets, it triggers, it creates, it establishes the legal authority of an independent and impartial court in relation to a citizen of a country which has not signed, ratified, or incorporated the very same treaty, the very same convention which sets up this court. And this is obviously very important. And the consequences of this are obviously multifaceted from an international point of view. First of all, the fact that China, Russia, and the US, three permanent members of the Security Council, the fact that they abstained in relation to Darfur when the resolution was brought to vote, when the issue was brought to a vote, and the fact that they have now agreed what I've just read, cited, besides the content of the entire resolution, possibly, some publicists are arguing, goes to show that definite state practice, or an agreement as to that state practice, which could lead to hard law, in the sense that state practice could lead to customary international law, because there seems to be a recurring trend in international law and international fora to ensure the prosecution of any alleged crimes, especially when these crimes are so-called core crimes. Now, I distinguish between a core crime and a treaty crime. A core crime is a crime which falls within the remit and parameters of the ICC statute, the statute of the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute. A treaty crime does not necessarily fall within those parameters. Now, the core crimes are all crimes under customary international law. The only crime which is not only a crime under customary international law, but also a crime under conventional, under treaty law, is the Genocide Convention 1948, the crime of genocide, which has been established by means of the convention, and the definition of which is reproduced verbatim in the ICC statute itself. So the situation is such that those are the core crimes, as opposed to the general treaty crimes, crimes emanating from international conventions. For example, those emanating from the 1971 Montreal Convention on the suppression of any unlawful acts against the safety of civil aviation, hostage taking, hijacking, terrorism, drug trafficking, etc. Those are treaty crimes. So in relation to core crimes, at least, especially by means of this resolution, I wouldn't say safely, but I would be able to start to argue today that a jus puniendi under international law is emerging. The right to prosecute and, should guilt be established, the right to punish. And this also tallies with the preamble of the International Criminal Court Statute, which is intended specifically to defeat impunity. So that is a major development. Another possible ramification or consequence of this unanimity of this Security Council resolution, and this is quite an unintended consequence, I must say, would be the effect of what certain publicists are stating is the implicit recognition of the jurisdiction of the court, in the sense that since China, USA, and Russia, three permanent members of the Security Council, which basically means the majority of the permanent members, have not ratified and signed the ICC statute. But on the other hand, they are recognizing and acknowledging, whether directly or indirectly, the jurisdiction of this court to try somebody or a group of persons who are allegedly responsible for the commission of core crimes. Would that be tantamount, especially given changes in circumstances in the respective countries? We have the new Obama administration, for example, in the US, which seems to be laxing slightly and becoming more flexible towards international criminal law per se, even as a branch of international law. Would this imply that, would their vote, would the fact that they have consented to the wording, the specific wording within this 1970 Security Council resolution, 1970 being the number, obviously, of the resolution, would this imply that they have now changed their stance in relation to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court? And the effect of that could be a rather unfavorable one. Because if this is so, and if they are pressed to believe, or if the international perception is such that they have possibly impliedly, by implication, recognized the court's jurisdiction, that could lead to a situation where, in the next set of circumstances, which can be similar to what's happening in Libya, we take the example of Syria, they might be reluctant to vote unanimously to this effect. So this would be a possible outcome and consequence, which is definitely undesired, of an implicit recognition, if this is the case, of such a resolution. I don't know whether there are any comments in relation to these points, or whether you'd like to ask any other further questions.
So the question is actually what triggers international intervention in the case of Libya and the Security Council resolution, which, as Dr. Solo has said, was voted unanimously in the case of Libya, but not in other cases. I mean, what are the factors, right? And I think this is quite an interesting question, in fact.
Probably what distinguishes the Libyan case with other cases is the following. First of all, the Security Council must have perceived the delicate strategic also position of Libya in the Mediterranean, in North Africa, as one which could lead to a potential domino effect in relation to various other matters, politically, geographically, especially in relation to the plight of refugees. So that would have been possibly considered as a threat to the peace itself. The unprecedented and the very, very systematic and gross and very widespread range of attacks, the fact that they have been so indiscriminate, was such as to lead also the Council to perceive such as an act of aggression, technically an act of aggression against one's own people. Now, the Security Council was also aided, besides information, visual information, I would say, through the internet, but especially by certain declarations, both pre-resolution but post-resolution especially, of, for example, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, who actually stated that there is evidence, and quite concrete evidence, even by means of other people within the Libyan government who have defected, possibly, to the effect that there was already a pre-planned policy of the Libyan government when there was an outbreak in Tunisia and Egypt, so before the 15th February Libyan crisis, before there were problems in Libya per se. But there is evidence to the effect that there were specific instructions and superior orders to commanders and armed forces to attack indiscriminately by shooting and actually killing, which would constitute obviously a crime against humanity, the civilian population, which is disloyal towards Gaddafi. Therefore, the particular circumstances of the case with Dr. Sadni and the volatile nature of this region with tribes and with probably people from different ethnic backgrounds possibly as well, with the neighboring states such as Chad, etc., which are so close, wherein also Gaddafi led to an involvement of these states indirectly or directly by recruiting persons from these states intentionally and deliberately to kill his own people. The volatile situation, the very, very blatant manifest evidence, and the perception that this could lead to a very, very serious, I wouldn't say war, but armed conflict in the region, probably led the Council to perceive the situation as particularly serious, more than in other states. But this does not necessarily mean that, first of all, that definitely crimes against humanity were committed, because this is not a judicial authority, obviously, the Security Council, but the International Criminal Court will determine this. The chief prosecutor is currently assessing, and in fact in the next days, actually today or tomorrow, should report to the United Nations whether there has actually been at least a reasonable basis to proceed in relation to crimes against humanity, because also of the widespread and systematic policy, because one of the elements of such crime, a constitutive element of crimes against humanity, is it's the knowledge that this crime is being committed as part of a widespread and systematic attack directed against a civilian population. So such knowledge is important as a constitutive element of the crime. It's part of it's the mens rea, actually. And in this context, there was enough evidence to show that there was already a pre-plan, a governmental and organizational policy to take such measures. And these measures, we're speaking of murder, extermination, torture, desaparecidos, enforced disappearance of persons, which is also a crime against humanity, and various other inhumane acts which constitute the crime itself.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in international law, acts of aggression are permitted in case of self-defense, right?
Can you repeat the question?
Acts of aggression are permitted.
In what?
In case of self-defense.
Under
right?
International
yes.
law.
In this case, considering the fact that the rebels were recognized as a parallel government who's contending the same landmass as the Gaddafi government, wouldn't the Gaddafi government be justified to defend itself?
Article 51 of the Charter considers both individual and collective self-defense as being permissible in certain circumstances. Now, the International Court of Justice has already pronounced itself on the matter. Self-defense can be preventive, where a country, a state, is foreseeing an attack, and that is illegal under international law. Self-defense can be anticipatory or preemptive, wherein an attack is very imminent. Now, in this case, we don't only have an imminent attack. We have an actual attack against a civilian population. We have an attack which allegedly constitutes crimes against humanity. And that is also the thrust and the objective and the aim of the resolution, because the resolution triggered the jurisdiction of the ICC, of the criminal court. And as a result of that, if Chief Prosecutor Moreno Ocampo decides that there's a reasonable basis to proceed, and the pretrial chamber confirms this, an international arrest warrant will be issued against Gaddafi and certain accomplices. So in the circumstances, I would say that the United Nations Charter is modeled to the extent that since the individual today is a subject of international law, just as much as an international institution and just as much as a state, the way it is modeled, the way it is drafted, and the way that state practice have interpreted it, including General Assembly and Security Council resolutions, is such that should an attack be committed directly against a civilian population in the indiscriminate way and systematic way, I think that would definitely be classified as an act of aggression entailing the possibility to respond by means of self-defense. And when I'm speaking of self-defense, I'm not meaning self-defense of the countries which are, of the alliance, which are now attacking military targets in Libya. We're speaking of self-defense in a rather broader context, wherein these countries are defending the rights of the Libyan people. In fact, if one looks at the resolution itself, the resolution imposes something which international law imposes already, that the fact, the obligation that the Libyan authorities, because every government and every state and every authority must protect its own people. So when the resolution affirms recalling the Libyan authorities' responsibility to protect its population, it is also implying, and it is quite clear, rather, it's not only implied, it's quite clear, that any attack in self-defense for these people, for Libyan people, who are being targeted simply because they are disloyal towards the regime, is such that, given the gradual escalation and the measures taken, and given the legitimacy of this, and it's perfectly legal under international law, because the Security Council is endowed with such vires, such powers, by the Charter, and incidentally, one must recall that many, many states in the world are also signatories to the United Nations Charter. In this context, I feel that the attack by the Allied forces was definitely justified under international law to protect the Libyan population.
It was recognized, the rebel council was recognized by France and other countries, for example, as a parallel government. I mean, the people who support the rebel council technically are not considered, should not be considered as citizens of Libya anymore, because they...
No, it doesn't mean so. To be recognized as a state, the Montevideo Convention clearly states that there must be a permanent population, a defined territory, a government, and the capacity to contract and enter into relations with other states. The TNC, I mean, I wouldn't be able to say whether this is, for all intents and purposes of law, a state already, but I really don't think so at this stage.
If I can say a word, I think we have to distinguish here between recognition of states and recognition of governments. Now, the issue here is not really much a recognition of state, but recognition of government. So when you are distinguishing between Gaddafi on the one hand and the TNC on the other, the issue is who is the legitimate government in that particular territory. We do not have any dispute as to whether Libya exists as a state, whether there is the four characteristics of statehood, the Montevideo Convention, etc. But the question is, who is the legitimate government of that particular territory? Is it the TNC or is it Gaddafi?
Incidentally, actually, Gaddafi is a de facto head of state. So there are doubts as well about his legitimacy. So technically, you can say that in Libya, there's no legitimate government at all, possibly. Some international lawyers are arguing to this effect, in fact.
He has actually said words to that effect himself, Gaddafi, right? He says that he can't actually resign because he has no post to resign from, in fact. So this also... Of course, I mean, this is probably a difficult question, but, you know, let's hypothesize. Imagine a Tiananmen-style scenario happened today. Would this come, would you imagine that this could come under the sort of umbrella of the international law statutes and so on that you are mentioning?
There's a very fine line between the... obligation, I would say, of the UN itself, not and to of various states, not to intervene within internal matters of a particular state, on one hand, and on the other hand, the necessity and the need to protect civilians of a state wherein those civilians are being targeted and attacks are being committed in relation to those civilians. Obviously, every case must be considered on a according to its circumstances, on a case-by-case basis, and one must consider the full set of circumstances. One of the most important points arising from the point that you have raised is that, technically speaking, there is no monitor, no authority, which is legally endowed with the power to screen and monitor decisions of the Security Council. And under international law, this is particularly relevant. In fact, it was discussed in the case of the International Court of Justice and obviously in the judgment delivered in the Lockerbie case, where Libya filed proceedings against the U.S. and USA on the basis of the fact, in relation to the Lockerbie bombing. Basically, this case dealt with an interpretation and application of Article 14 of the 1971 Montreal Convention. And the ICJ held that the Security Council's powers are quite broad. However, it can judicially review such powers only if a case is brought before the court, only if the court feels the necessity to determine such legality and validity of the resolution in order to be able to deliver a judgment in the case, as happened in the Lockerbie case. So this is quite interesting in the sense that the Security Council has certain powers which are very broad, but not completely without any judicial review at all. And probably this has also the effect, obviously, in the sense that the International Court of Justice is the ultimate arbiter, if we could speak, use this phrase, of security, of the validity and the content and interpretation as well of Security Council resolutions. And obviously the International Criminal Court too is the ultimate arbiter of its own jurisdiction. So technically speaking, if a case has been triggered by the Security Council and the court, the ICC, has jurisdiction, technically speaking, if the ICC feels upon a plea of defense counsel of an accused, of a person charged and indicted, if the ICC feels that it is not clear that the Security Council has triggered such jurisdiction, or that the resolution itself does not imply or convey that, technically speaking, the ICC might determine that it has no jurisdiction over the accused in that particular case.
Particularly with relevance to the bombing that occurred, I believe, last Saturday, where NATO is now being accused that it has overstepped its mandate and it was attacking individuals, specifically Gaddafi's youngest son, I believe. Who will check that the Allied forces and NATO is not overstepping its mandate? Who has the jurisdiction to? Because, you know, there's the political side, as you were saying, you know, Allied forces, NATO joined against Libya, but who is going to check that the Allied forces are doing their job?
Here we're considering two situations. I definitely agree with the point you raised in the sense that the killing of people does not form part of this resolution, is not catered for, and does not fall within its parameters. However, technically speaking, one should consider everything cumulatively in the light of the whole set of circumstances. The remedy to all this could be twofold. You could have a remedy from an international law point of view, in the sense that a delict was committed. In the strict sense of the word, a delict. We're speaking of international law here in the sense of punitive damages. We're speaking of this in that context. So here we're speaking of something entailing state responsibility. So technically, nothing stops Libya from proceeding before the International Court of Justice, claiming that the acts by the Allied forces resulting in the deaths of its citizens and the destruction itself were not proportionate, and secondly, are ultra vires, because we're not within the parameters of the Security Council. That is one thing. That would be state responsibility before the International Court of Justice from the point of view of an international delict. On the other hand, then we could have what a state might consider, and nothing stops Libya as a state to inform the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court that a crime, in its opinion, has been committed. Libya could be, technically, and the prosecutor could do this himself out of his own initiative, or Libya as well could bring this to the attention of the Security Council itself. Libya could simply state that this action of the Allied forces could also constitute a war crime in itself, per se. Now, Libya would probably not do that because Libya has not recognized and acknowledged the importance of the Security Council. In fact, just after the 1970, Resolution 1970, Gaddafi basically simply stated that this has no legitimate authority, the Security Council per se, and that basically it has no sense and it could not bind Libya in any way. So it would be very inconsistent of him and very contradictory to go and plead to the Security Council that at this stage an international delict was committed and possibly also a crime under international law. But this has two, one could look at it the issued matter you raise as an international delict entailing state responsibility before the International Court of Justice, and on the other hand, because there is no state criminal responsibility, as possibly an alleged crime under international law because of an act which is completely ultra vires, allegedly.
And another state, not Libya, could potentially do that too, right? Imagine it's not Libya who does
another state could do that, possibly on the basis of universal jurisdiction. But the same may be said of various other instances. I mean, the killing of bin Laden, I mean, Obama classified it as justice has been served and done. Technically speaking, international law does not permit the killing of an individual in this way, notwithstanding how many people he has killed, tortured, etc. So what could be applied to this state of affairs could be applied to various other circumstances. And in fact, the former president of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, Professor Antonio Cassese, has repeatedly stated that it would be a clear, blatant violation of international law should the Allied forces attempt to kill to depose Gaddafi.
Professor, I would like to take, you know, to address the issue of neutrality. So the neutrality clause in Malta's constitution, what it means in the context of the Libyan crisis, in the context of the Security Council resolution, and unfortunately we invited the foreign minister to this debate, but unfortunately he could not make it at the last minute. So what about the way, you know, things are developing actually in practical terms? How does it all fit into this?
I think the first problem that we have here is that we have to understand what does really our constitution state on the matter. In fact, our constitution is very original, if I can use that word, because if you look at Article 1, sub-Article 3, it essentially says that Malta is a neutral state, so the first point is neutral state, actively pursuing peace, security and social progress, and this is what a neutral state usually does among all persons, by adhering to a policy of non-alignment. So our neutrality is being qualified. So it is not just simply neutrality, but it is neutrality qualified by non-alignment and by refusing to participate in any military alliance. So in reality, we are not really a neutral state. We are a neutral state. We are a state which is non-aligned, and we are a state which refuses to participate in any military alliance. Those are the ingredients of, let us say, our neutrality in order to try and comprise the three of them under one heading, if we can use that term for this purpose. Then the Constitution goes into details, and it gives us examples of what should not be permitted and what would be considered to be in breach of neutrality, in breach of non-alignment, and in breach of participating in any military alliance. And there are the examples there, so I mean, one can just simply read them, and that is the position. Now, the problem is that neutrality is a legal term. So if you look up at the books of international law, public international law, you do get to find a definition of what neutrality is all about. The other ingredient, non-alignment, non-alignment is not a legal term, so I cannot define what non-alignment is. I can obviously read what the non-aligned movement has stated in its declaration as what it considers to be non-alignment. So basically, there is a whole list of what non-alignment is all about. But you must have to remember one important thing, that now the question of non-alignment has become practically irrelevant in today's situation, because when the Constitution was written, or better, when the amendment to the Constitution was introduced in 1987, at that time we were living in a world which was totally different from the world as we know it today. We were living in a scenario of Cold War, a Cold War situation, where you had essentially two superpowers, and basically they divided the world amongst themselves. That was the situation in 1987. We also know, however, that a few years later, this situation and the scenario changed drastically, and today we can say that we are living not in a bipolar world, but in a unipolar world, where essentially the great power of the day is the United States of America. The USSR, the Soviet Union, is no longer as it used to be. It has dismembered itself into 15
Soviets, as they were called, the constitutive states of the Soviet Union. So basically we have got 15 countries rather than one country, which was the USSR. And therefore Russia, which we consider to be the legitimate successor in terms of state succession to the USSR, is essentially not the powerful USSR which it was when we had a bipolar world. So the first difficulty which arises in this question is, what is non-alignment today? Now, I don't have an answer, of course, to this question, but there is a rule of statutory interpretation which says that when you have a difficulty to interpret a law, you have to read the law as though that law has been enacted in a particular moment in time. In other words, if the law was enacted in 1987, the amendments to the Constitution of Malta dealing with this threefold element which I have mentioned, you have to interpret them as they were written in 1987, May or whatever the month was of 1987. Now, to interpret the Constitution today by applying that principle still does not take us anywhere, because at that time the reality was that we were living in a bipolar world. Today the reality is totally different. So if a Maltese court is seized with a case and the question of non-alignment arises, then obviously there's going to be a big problem, because the situation has changed. So what does non-alignment today mean exactly? It is very difficult to state, especially when you have to keep in consideration that Malta was, and I presume still is, a member of the non-aligned movement, but the non-aligned movement is no longer the non-aligned movement of 1987, where it was very much active. Today, practically, it is a dead organization. Now, the third ingredient of the Constitution, refusing to participate in any military alliance, essentially, that is what I would have considered to be an ingredient of neutrality. So one of the ingredients of neutrality, if you are a neutral state, automatically implies that you cannot participate in any military alliance. So I ask myself, why did the legislator wanted to stress only one specific ingredient of what neutrality is all about? Now, the sentence which I read from Article 1, Sub-Article 3 is obviously the most important sentence in the whole sub-article. The rest are simply examples of what Malta is insofar as these three constitutive ingredients are concerned. Now, another problem which the Constitution provision provides to us is that it uses the word will. Such a status will in particular imply that, and then, no foreign military base will be permitted. No military facilities in Malta will be allowed, etc., etc., etc. So there is this use of terminology which is basically not used in legislative drafting. When we draft a law, essentially we use either shall or may. Shall normally means that it is something which is mandatory. May normally means that it is something which is discretionary, although there can be instances where may also means shall in statutory drafting, but normally that is the exception rather than the rule. Now, what does this word will mean in the context of a law where usually we do not use this terminology? Now, the problem is that this provision, Article 1.3, is essentially taken ad literam from the declaration by the government of the Republic of Malta concerning the neutrality of Malta. So Malta had made this declaration in the 1980s, and when the parliament was considering to amend the constitution in 1987, the text of this declaration was adopted lock, stock and barrel into Maltese law. In other words, it was not adopted for the purposes of the Constitution. And therefore, we are stuck, therefore, with this question of will as to whether the will is a may or whether the will is a shall. Now, irrespective, however, of what the will is all about, whether it's shall or may, the position is that we can still take on board whatever is written in these five paragraphs of Article 1, Sub-Article 3, essentially on the basis of the fact that the preceding three lines, which I read earlier, are so generic that basically you can include whatever is written in these five paragraphs. So even, I would say, if one would still consider a will not to be mandatory, not to be obligatory, one can still infer what is written in the five paragraphs in the Constitution from the generic statement that Malta is a neutral state, it is adhering to a policy of non-alignment, and it refuses to participate in any military alliance. Now, the second point, insofar as national law, because this is, I'm speaking here of national laws concerned, is essentially, what is the neutrality of Malta? Now, neutrality normally comes in international law when there are two or more states who are at war against each other. Here we are speaking of an international war. We are not speaking of a civil war, so a war within a particular state. We are here speaking of an international war, a war between a number of states. And that is where neutrality normally comes into the picture. So if Libya and Italy are at war against each other, Malta has to decide what it is going to do. Is it going to side with Libya? Is it going to side with Italy? Or is it going to take a totally neutral stand and side with nobody? Now, in our case, in reality, we are not really a neutralized state, as international law refers to neutrality, i.e. the situation of two states which are being at war. We are something more than that in reality, according to our constitution. Our constitution essentially refers to a different concept, which is the concept of neutralization. So therefore, we have the concept of neutrality, we have the concept of neutralization, and you have also the concept of neutralism, three international law concepts in this field. Now, neutralism is essentially a policy of neutrality. In other words, it is not written in your own law. Neutralization is written in the law, like the case of Malta. It is very clearly written down in Article 1, Sub-Article 3 of the Constitution, which is, which is obviously the fundamental law of the state, the supreme law of the state. Neutralism is the case, for example, of Austria, the case of Sweden and other countries, Ireland, etc., where they are neutral states, but it is a question of policy. In other words, the government of the day can change it, not even without the need of getting parliamentary approval for that policy. In the case of Malta, I said that this is not the case because we are in the case of neutralization, which therefore means that neutralization is a permanent status. So contrary to neutrality and contrary to neutralism, neutralization is a permanent status, which means that Malta is neutral forever, of course, unless the constitution is changed. And therefore, in that particular circumstances, the responsibilities, the obligations of Malta would obviously differ from the responsibilities of a state which would fall under the other two categories. Because a neutral state can be neutral in one case and can be participating in a war in another case. So, for example, at a given moment in time, you can have two wars taking place. There is a war between, let us say, Italy and Libya, and there is another war between Tunisia and Italy. Now, it could be that Morocco, in the case of the war between Italy and Libya, takes a neutral stand. But in the war between Tunisia and Italy, decides to take an active stand in favor of Tunisia. You see? So that is the case of neutrality. You can be neutral, and you need not be neutral at one and the same time, because neutrality is essentially limited in time, and it is also limited in space. But when you come to the question of neutralization, the question is totally different, because Malta is always neutral. Ab initio, whatever conflict, armed conflict there might be, and here I'm speaking of an international armed conflict, because neutrality comes into the picture insofar as an international armed conflict is concerned, then in that particular case, Malta is neutral. Now, if I come to the point of Libya, because I don't really have more to say on the point of the Constitution, essentially, there can be certain cases which one might think of, and one might say, Malta has or has not been consonant with its status of permanent neutrality, as it is. So, for example, when Malta was assisting those 14,000 or 15,000 foreign nationals which were leaving Libya and coming over to Malta, and Malta was assisting them in order to repatriate themselves to their own country, was Malta taking a stand in that particular case, which was, you know, against the interests of one of the parties? We have got two parties here, Gaddafi on the one hand, and the TNC on the other, and therefore if Malta is assisting the evacuation of foreign nationals, is it taking a stand in favor of one or the other? Again, when the two Mirage Libyan aeroplanes came over to Malta, and the Maltese government reluctantly decided not to return the aircrafts back, even though, according to international law, we all know that they are property of the state of Libya, and Malta has an obligation to return the property of the state of Libya, in this case, the two Mirage aeroplanes back. Now, the thing was that Malta, in my opinion, in these two examples which I mentioned, was still compliant with its permanent neutrality status. Why? Because if you look at the case of the Mirage aeroplanes, which landed in Malta, there is the Security Council resolution which Dr. Soler has referred to in his intervention, which essentially says in paragraph 9, I'll just read that paragraph, which deals with arms embargo, and it says that the member states of the United Nations cannot help the state of Libya by providing arms, etc., etc. So in that particular instance, although it is true that the aeroplanes belong to the state of Libya, but if Malta were to return those aeroplanes to the state of Libya, then Malta would be in breach of the United Nations Security Council resolution. So in that particular instance, Malta, in my opinion, acted in conformity with its status of permanent neutrality. If it had sent them back to the legitimate owner, the state of Libya, then Malta would have been in breach, in my opinion, of the permanent neutrality status. The question of the evacuation of foreign nationals, which I referred to before, again is also catered by the Security Council resolution, because in paragraph 3 it says the Security Council is saying it requests all member states, to the extent possible, to cooperate in the evacuation of those foreign nationals wishing to leave the country. So if we have ships organized by Virtu Ferries, or whatever the Maltese company was called, which is going to Libya, and it is getting foreign persons over to Malta so that they can be repatriated in their own country, then in that particular instance, Malta is not in breach of its constitution, permanent neutrality, nor is it in breach of the UN Security Council resolution. Another case which could have been mentioned is the request by Libya to the Maltese government to act as a mediator in the situation, in the conflict, in the internal conflict between the two sides, Gaddafi and the Council, the Transitional National Council. In that particular case, once again, the government refused, the Maltese government refused. And I think in that case, the government was also correct. Now, it is true that, as we learn in law, when you are a mediator, you do not take sides, but you try to bring the two parties together in order to solve their dispute. So basically, you are not taking a stand. But sometimes it does happen that the mediation process falls down, and one of the parties alleges that the mediator is siding with the other side, even though that might not necessarily be truly the case, but do these things do happen. So I think even in this specific aspect, it was a wise decision not to conduct mediation proceedings between the two states, as that might have tarnished the permanent neutrality status of the state of Malta. Now, the protection of the diplomatic mission. We all know from the newspaper coverage and television coverage that Malta was protecting the embassy of Libya and therefore, again, in terms of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Privileges of 1963, Malta has an obligation to protect the mission's territory as well as the personnel, and therefore, again, there is no problem in that respect. Another question which I would like to ask is whether Malta involved in the military offensive against Libya, the no-fly zone issue, and whether aeroplanes are departing from here to enforce that no-fly zone, or perhaps even taking more drastic measures which might perhaps even go beyond what the Security Council resolution is speaking about. And I think this is surely not the case, because Malta is only accepting to receive aeroplanes when the aeroplanes are having difficulties, either because they have run out of fuel or because of some other emergency. There might be some technical fault in the operation of the aircraft, and therefore, in order to save life, here you are saving the life of the pilot, and the pilot is coming to Malta not to attack the Maltese people, not to, to do something which is illegal in terms of international law, but it is just simply an emergency situation. And as we know from our cases of illegal immigration, when our armed forces of Malta go out at sea in order to assist the immigrants and bring them here, that is basically on the same lines. And the last point which I would like to mention, and I will conclude on this, is the question of recognition of the transitional National Council by Malta. Now, as we have read in the newspapers, we know that there have been certain situations where the transitional National Council has been recognized by Italy, by France, and I'm not sure whether it was also by Qatar as well. But the point is that there is an element of recognition. Now, what we have to keep in mind from a law point of view, because after all we are lawyers, not experts in international relations here or politics, is that from a legal point of view, recognition is not a legal act. In the sense, let me clarify what I mean by not a legal act. Recognition is a political act. It is a political act. In other words, any state in the world can recognize an entity, even if that entity does not qualify to be a state in terms of the Montevideo Convention on the Recognition of States of 1933. Now, as you have studied in international law, it is the Montevideo Convention which sets out the four ingredients of statehood: the defined territory, the capacity to enter into international relations, government, and permanent population. So those are the four ingredients which you find in the Montevideo Convention. Recognition is not an ingredient in the Montevideo Convention of Statehood, and recognition, therefore, is not a legal characteristic of statehood. Now, when the Vatican City, for example, applied to the United Nations to become a full member of the United Nations, the United Nations had rejected the application on the basis of the fact that the Holy See at that time did not qualify for statehood under the Montevideo Convention. And the same basically happened to small states, the micro-states, such as Monaco, Andorra, Liechtenstein, San Marino, etc. But in the 1990s, the United Nations reversed this policy. And today, the micro-states are members or full members of the United Nations, except the Vatican City so far, if I remember correctly. So recognition, therefore, is a political act. So a state can decide to recognize the Transitional National Council, even if the Transitional National Council might not have one or more of the four ingredients of statehood. For example, I do not think that at the present moment in time the Transitional National Council has the capacity to enter into international relations, because it is only recognized by, so far as I'm aware, three states, you see? So there is that problem, that that criterion is not settled. Defined territory, again, the territory is moving. Today it is conquered by Gaddafi, the next day it is the Transitional National Council which has conquered the territory. So the territory, you don't know exactly who is in charge of the territory. Is there a case of government in the... Again, it is very difficult to say that there is a government, because for there to be a government, it must have total control of whatever is happening in that territory, which is not the case, because we have got Gaddafi, which, with his army, which is entering into the territory without authorization, etc., etc. So one has to distinguish, this is the final point which I would like to make, between what is legal, i.e. the four characteristics of statehood, and those are legal, and what is political, which is recognition. And you can recognize a state even though it does not have these four ingredients, or the obverse, you can decide not to recognize the state even though it qualifies. Take the case of the Turkish Federated State of Cyprus, which has all the four ingredients to be recognized as a state, but then there are various United Nations Security Council resolutions which are requesting the state of Turkey to withdraw from Northern Cyprus, and obviously the international community is not recognizing the Turkish Federated State of Cyprus, not because it does not have the four characteristics of statehood, but because of political considerations.
Thank you, Professor Aquilina, for that excellent exposé. Okay, so thanks a lot for attending, and see you next year, I hope, with the Law Debating Society. We will definitely keep on organizing these debates. Hopefully they will be better attended than the second one. The first one was very well attended, but I wish you the best of luck with your exams. Thanks a lot.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Law Debating Society entitled The International Aspects of the Libyan Crisis. This talk was chaired by Dr. David Frigeri.